Hello, everyone. Welcome to Anonymous Open Mic. My name is Alyssa Cipher, and I'm the executive director of Inside Our Minds. We're an organization that works to elevate the voices of people with lived experience of mental illness and madness in Pittsburgh. Some of you here are familiar faces. Welcome back. For those of you who are new, we have done 3 anonymous open mics before this. This is the 4th, and we're excited to bring anonymous open mic to Millvale and to co-host with Creative Nonfiction, the Writing Away the Stigma program, to help reach out to younger voices and generally spread the word about speaking loud and proud about mental illness. So welcome again. Let me look at my notes. So before I start, I wanted to acknowledge all the people that helped to make this anonymous open mic happen. Obviously, the Millvale Community Library is awesome. This is their space, so please clap for them. Yay! They do a lot of awesome events here and let us use this yard, so we're very thankful for them. I'd also like to thank Creative Nonfiction, who supplied the food and drink in the back, which you should partake in. And they also brought on the interpreters from Sign Language Interpreting Professionals. Yay. So that's really awesome. And I also want to thank over here, the guys from the Social Voice Project. They donated their live sound and recording services for today's event and otherwise are awesome guys to have around to fix all your tech problems. And finally, we have to thank our fiscal sponsor, New Sun Rising, who is right down the street in the Millvale Moose. They help Inside Our Minds be a nonprofit and put these events on in Pittsburgh. So thank you, New Sun Rising. So we're going to get into the first part of the program, which is readings from the graduates of the Writing Away the Stigma program. These 4 teens are awesome people, and I know because I served as the mental health specialist for this event. I had no idea that it would be so awesome to go into work every week and hear the things that these kids had to say. I keep saying kids, teens, young adults, sorry for being patronizing, but it was an awesome 8 weeks of learning about all the voices and all the stories they wanted to tell, helping them to grow as writers and to just be kind of goofy a lot of the time in the workshops. So I'm excited to bring them up here today to read a couple pieces. So without further ado, I want to introduce Vivian Lee Croft, who will be introing all the teens today. Vivian.
Hi, I'm Vivian Lee Croft. I'm the founder of Girls Write Pittsburgh, and I've had a great relationship with Creative Nonfiction Magazine for quite a few years since my internship with them about 10 years ago. And I was delighted to be invited to be part of the Writing Away the Stigma for Young Adults program. Creative Nonfiction Magazine had done 2 previous iterations of Writing Away the Stigma for adult writers, and this time they brought on teen writers who did a phenomenal job. Very heartwarming, very inspiring. The stories, the relationships, the community that came out of these workshops every week was something that you'll be able to partake in right now as we bring them up to read. Our first reader tonight is Bridget Van Haltem. She's a 10th grader whose poetry has been published in the literary journal Pulp. She enjoys screenwriting and hopes to make people laugh throughout the world someday. Let's give a warm welcome to Bridget.
Hello. I just want to give a disclaimer. When I read this last time, people didn't know what it was about, so I'm just going to say it now. I know that you should like express that through your writing, but I'm sorry. So this is about anxiety. Okay. The heat of the day called me to the sweet thought of immersing myself in cool chlorine. The other kids dip their scared toes in the water to see if they jump or slowly descend down the pool stairs, flinching after every inch of their skin went deeper down into the clear cold. I, on the other hand, was not afraid.
I readied myself on the damp pavement like a runner in the Olympics, slightly bending my knees and circling the fresh air throughout my lungs before pushing the ground away with my feet and leaping to the curious water. In a split second, the sounds of the suburban mothers and their laughing children were muffled out by the rush of water filling my ears. It filled every crevice and curve my body had, having no mercy as to where it went. It welcomed me with a cool embrace that could only be shed by the rays of the sun. The water held my hands, wrinkling my fingertips up like raisins and refusing to let go until it had pulled me back into it. I couldn't resist the crystal ripples and the shadows that swayed below the surface, the bubbles that rose and exploded when I would jump in. It restricted my movements, but I felt like I was floating without the fear of colliding with the ground. But as soon as I left, the safe cool that protected me from the unforgiving sun, I had been hit with the bitterness the waters had. The clear chlorine chained my hands, puckering and drying my skin till my wrinkles formed cracks. While I thought the waters shielded me from the harsh rays of the sun, it was deceiving, making me believe it was paradise when in fact it was a parasite. But the familiarity of the chlorine overruled the honesty of the sun, so I immersed myself once again in hopes that the waters would fill the cracks it had formed in my skin. This time, I wasn't safe. The clear cool didn't want me to leave. I had strayed before, attempting to fix what the chlorine had done, and the waters had to make up for lost time. The current chained me down, and water slipped past my lips and through my throat, filling me up so it could become a part of me. I was blinded by the bleach clawing at my eyes, and by now I was sinking into the depths of lies and deceit. What had felt so forgiving and safe was now trying to kill me. The security blanket was now tied in knots around my bones. I couldn't escape. Reality sank in. My body and mind were trapped. Now I didn't have a choice as to if I wanted to be submerged by cool chlorine. Now it was a part of me. So now I know. Comfort doesn't always mean safety, and safety does not mean freedom. Thank you.
Thank you, Bridget. Our next reader tonight is Sarisa Morsaint. Sarisa is an aspiring ASL interpreter and Spanish translator who hopes to turn her experiences into creative nonfiction. Please welcome Sarisa.
I'm actually reading two pieces tonight. The first one is a poem, and the second one is flash fiction, I guess. This is called Savannah. Stained glass lenses that hold onto my lashes. If I blink, I may miss. And in all the churches, I see a heaven. In the windows. In all of the pews, I see words of red and blue, yellow, dear gods, dear lords, the spirit. They dance and dance until they trip over nothing. If it is night and I see nothing, has the moon lost its wisdom? If it is day and the sun does not warm me, does it no longer exist? If the leaves are all gone, has nature lost her way? In these forests, our trees stretch. They hold hands in the bright blue sky. When I look up, I see new patterns. When I look down, those patterns become shadows. This one is untitled. As a kid, I sat in my bedroom giggling over plastic diamonds and snap-on earrings. I wore cheap beads that hung down my chest, and my pink dresses lay scattered all over the floor. I remember when we first moved into our house on Green Springs. It was with the first girl my dad ever brought home after he and my mom split up. But the life we started together was far after the days of me staring her down and wondering if she was good enough for my dad. These were the days of me, the little six-year-old, running through the dusty doorways of our new empty place and calling dibs on the biggest bedroom in the house. But my dad was lame, and I was given the second biggest bedroom in the house because I was 3 feet tall and couldn't possibly take up that much room. I begged to differ, but Dad didn't care. In my new room, the walls were bare. There were no toys, and the windows were covered with blinds, So I wrapped my little hands around that weird skinny thing that you twist and waited for the blinds to ascend. Standing on my toes, I eyed at the windowsill where dead bees lay on their backs with broken wings and fuzzy stomachs. The previous owner had left them behind as a housewarming gift for us. And something about them terrified me. Their bent legs and still stingers. Even though they couldn't hurt me, I was afraid the heat of my breath would awake them and they'd be angry with me. Their stingers sharp, their wings ready. But the bees were swept away by the new girl Dad brought home. I smiled at her, astonished by her bravery. She supplied a safeness in the new house I had yet to receive. I remember the pink and sparkly princess nightlet I had. It slowly spun, displaying Cinderella and Snow White on the walls. It was peaceful. It was quiet. And those were the nights where I didn't need Mr. Bear to keep me safe. I just wanted him by my side. But at Mom's house, it was different. We'd lived there since I was 3, and I just got a new bunk bed. At Mom's house, the shadow people came. Every night at 12, I woke up to slithering shadows climbing up my bed. There were so many of them, and they were all silent. I would scream. And if she didn't wake up, I would scream until she did. I'd refuse to go to my bed in my own room, and we moved my mattress next to hers. But I didn't feel safe there either. The shadow people still came. Only this time they dropped from the ceiling and only went away when I closed my eyes. I recently read from an old book that shadow people are an old Navajo legend, where your negative thoughts manifest themselves into a dark figure. Only I'm not so sure they were my thoughts, because now I know that grown-ups don't see them. They just feel them deeply. Sometimes I wonder if the shadow people were that of my mother, but chased me because of her fear of who I'd become, and if she was doing a good enough job. I don't see them anymore, and I'd like to think it's because she's proud of me.
Thanks, Sarisa. Our next young writer is Jacob Volk. Jacob is a 16-year-old writer from West Allegheny High School. They aspire to study psychology after high school and benefit others through their experiences. Please welcome Jacob.
So I'm also going to be reading two pieces. Both of them are poems, though. This first one is about looking at my life through a third-person perspective, kind of. Sixth grade English class. He sat in the corner of class with newly made friends who hadn't come from his elementary school. That's where he met her. Blonde, flowing hair and aquamarine eyes that gleamed at any joke he said. They became friends. Seventh grade refined his relationships. New friends finalized and past ones retired. She convinced you to join our club, and he went every week with her. When jazz band stopped her from coming, he'd go alone and meet her afterwards. She was his best friend, and his best friend was her. Eighth grade brought anxiety. He silently battled throughout the years before and after they met. She sat at his table in geometry, but our seats were moved from talking too much. He tried sitting near her again, only to repeat what happened before. He texted her at 2 a.m. before the sun rose, yet she still responded. He told her his secrets, and she kept them like her own. Ninth grade allowed them to share an art class. The year before, she voted you as most artistic boy of eighth grade, and that was your title in the eighth grade yearbook. High school brought stress, but laughter as well. She sat with him on a bus ride to a field trip to a haunted house. She held his hand because he was petrified of what was inside and hugged him when tears cascaded down in response to a scary clown. 10th grade, he told her he wasn't a he. She was there throughout, coaxed away the suicidal thoughts, cried when they attempted to cut their wrists and listen to their confused thoughts. They returned the favor by showing empathy at 4 a.m. a Sunday night. They knew how to handle insomnia and nightmares. Her aquamarine eyes never fail to gleam in the dark. And they know they'll always have her. Thank you. So my next piece I typed up on my phone, it's called Fireflies, and it's just kind of a summertime poem. There's something about catching fireflies that always remains magical. Like, they went to Hogwarts for a couple weeks only to learn the spell Lumos before leaving, because that's all they really need. Instead of a wand, they use alchemy with their catalyst bodies and chemical reactions to blink on and off, on and off, on and off in that warm summer air, just as the long days end, as if the sun itself is just one large firefly just hovering above us. I remember catching fireflies before 4th of July fireworks, frolicking in the grass, silently stalking the bioluminescent beetles I knew would appear any moment. And after eons of waiting, a star would be born from nothing. From nothing, there's something, that all too familiar yellow light. And just as soon as it appears, two more appear, and nothing. The burning stars ignite in sequence, one after another, until entire galaxies fly out of the darkness. I see Andromeda and the Milky Way collide. I see into the infinite vastness of space. I see solar systems not thought possible, lights orbiting lights, orbiting lights, and it's gone. The firefly's light begins to fade dark against the summer night sky. They disappear into silent supernovas. One by one, the galaxies collapse. Space becomes empty. And I remember how lonely it is. How easy it is to feel alone when there's nothing. I watch the last firefly I have cupped in my hand. There's just something magical about catching a firefly, being able to look down through your fingers and seeing its glow. It's like you have a star in your palm just hovering there in all of its cosmic beauty. But like all light, it leaves my hand like a shooting star in reverse, and I can do nothing but sit there and wish the fireflies will come back the next night. Thank you.
Our final reader for this evening is Juno Nascimento. Juno is a 15-year-old who attends Lincoln Park for writing and publishing. In the future, he plans to become a screenwriter and work to promote tolerance, acceptance, and peace. Please welcome Juno.
We stand every morning and say, "I pledge allegiance to the flag." Let me rephrase that. They stand every morning and say, "I pledge allegiance to the flag." When I was a kid, I would stand with them. I would voice the passage chiseled into the walls of my mind. That is when I thought those words meant something. They meant a lot to them. God forbid you don't say them. God forbid you kneel when others say them. God forbid you don't like American football. God forbid the desire to voice an opinion to preserve your own life. God forbid homosexuality. God forbid a guy with breasts. God forbid a guy with breasts in the same restroom as my son. God forbid you speak your own language in my barber shop. God forbid you speak anything other than English in this country. God forbid you immigrate here in the first place. They stand every morning and repeat the words, "I pledge allegiance to the flag." When I was a kid, I didn't realize those words meant, "I'll either take off the end of your last name or you can't become a citizen." For green card jokes, for losing my right to love my own country. When I was a kid, I couldn't say enough that I'm Brazilian. The pride I held in my culture, in my country, it was a force. When I was a kid, I didn't know people would find something wrong with me being Brazilian. I didn't know people would make remarks about my family not belonging or getting deported. When I was a kid, I never feared getting deported. But I never knew how much the country I lived in my entire life would hate me.
They would hate me without hearing the bossa nova that would play in the kitchen when my parents made breakfast. They would hate me without knowing the sound of my father saying he loves me in Portuguese. They would hate me without seeing my mother's hips move to the sound of music. They would hate me without smelling the meat at our churrascos. They would hate me without hearing my mother's lullabies about a house with no walls and a girl with curly hair. They would hate me without seeing Sítio Pica-Pau Amarelo. They would hate me without knowing a thing about me or where my family comes from. They stand every morning and say the words, "I pledge allegiance to the flag." And they would shove a first generation and all of his culture in a cardboard box on the side so it wouldn't cloud their perfect American dream. Thank you.
Wow, thanks everyone. Please give a hand to our four young writers from the Writing Away the Stigma for Young Adults workshop series. Thanks for having us tonight.
So now we're gonna move into the anonymous open mic portion of the night. And I am floored by those four performances. So it's hard to just move on, but I think everyone here can appreciate the hard work and dedication that Bridget, Sarisa, Juno, and Jacob put in. So give another hand for them. So to start with the anonymous open mic, I want to just introduce the concept for anyone that's new to this programming. So anonymous open mic is a place to openly express your experiences with mental illness. And since we want everyone to be able to express themselves, we give the option to tell your story publicly or anonymously. Tonight, you'll see speakers who are performing their own works. And you'll also see speakers who are volunteering to perform the works of people who cannot identify themselves for any reason. These people send their submissions in through email, and we find a performer that's willing to give life to their voice. It's an amazing thing to listen to, and it's even more amazing when speakers who were anonymous in the past come to future events and choose to be public with their works. So we're excited to bring, I think, 13 pieces for you today. That being said, the pieces today have a wide range of emotions. Some are hopeful and uplifting, where some are angry or depressing or sad. And this is the reality of people who are involved in the mental health system. There is an array of experiences. And tonight, I want to invite you all to be comfortable with being uncomfortable, to listen to this array of emotions and see the full experience. And with that, I'm going to leave you with a quote that was on one of my podcasts this morning that is really fitting. So this is a quote by Luvi Ajayi. It says, "People and systems count on our silence to keep us exactly where we are. And in a world that wants us to whisper, I choose to yell." With that being said, I'm going to introduce our first performer, Sammy Silk, who will be performing Take the Memory on the ukulele.
Have you ever wished that you could just fade out of someone's memory? Bet you haven't wished that on another person, I'm just crazy. One day I wake be hard one day, wake up in the there bizarre, but hopefully it goes soon. Hopefully you leave me soon. One day I wake up and realize I'll never be enough if you stay with me. Please leave me, I'm begging you. I don't wanna wake up only to realize I'm never gonna be enough as long as you stay with me. Please leave me and take the memory.
And next, we're gonna have Untitled Works by Michael Ruby.
This will be fun. I'm gonna give you guys a bit of, you can all hear me, I'm assuming. Yeah, of course. I'll give you guys a bit of a pre-warning. This is poems about major depression. If you feel uncomfortable, I'm sorry, truly am. The moon dips down and the world forever cast it in this lake of darkness. No place of shining light to guide me through the treacherous maze of death, sadness, sorrow, and pain. In this life, I stand alone, only imagining to have a light. I watch all the people suffer in agony just like mine. I would take their pain. The sun forgot to take its rain, and the moon weeps. Starts its twinkling tears. Perhaps I wasn't meant to simply be here at all. The way I cause destruction where I stand, I must only be no more than a burden. This realm of eternal night takes hold of this twisted, tainted soul of mine. Please forgive me for what I have done and what is only on my path. I am sorry I'm here. I'm so sorry I was born. That's all. Thank you.
And now we're going to have Psychoanalysis Part 1 by Danielle Hooks.
So many things I want to tell you, but I fear I cannot. Not a word. A single utter of pure sanity. Spirals of ideas, mind-blogging pictures of what needs to be, what should be, what is, tangled up in a knot. It's what I see in my head. The revelations reeling out of control, unfiled, unsorted, miscellaneous, genius, and irrational all the same, but all black. No color, just black. A ball of mess bouncing off the walls of my skull, and all I can do is write. For it is thinking that got me this far, and to the place where I can't move on, and it won't let me out.
Next, we're going to have two anonymous readings, I Won't Shut Up and Younger Self, as performed by Kate Gross-Cantor.
You think you can keep me quiet, but I won't shut up anymore. You can't oppress me anymore. I am free. I am reborn. I get to make my own choices. I get to say whatever I want. Why do you silence me? My words are paved with golden bricks, each one bearing the pain of its creation. You are frightened, I know. You are frightened by my truth. Don't be. I am strong. It is not about honor or pride or shaming the community. It is about truth. You can't shut me up because now all I am is truth. Truth cannot be silenced any longer. My balloon is overfilled. I won't let it go. It has a mind of its own and will not listen to reason. I will hold on to the balloon. Let some air out a little at a time. Control the release. It's in your hands. The pushing down and stuffing away part of my life is over. I am embracing my pain, my strength, my growth. This butterfly has left its cocoon. There is no going back now. Feel the fear. Do it anyways. Younger self, innocent. Don't be hopeless, I tell myself. Never conquering my fears, constantly shedding tears. Why didn't I learn, I tell myself. Why didn't I find my true self?
So next, we have Keith Godschalk performing Wrong, as well as an anonymous piece that he will later introduce.
He's hiding in the closet again, the teacher said. Why? Mom asked. He's afraid of other children, she said. I was only 6, but I sensed something's wrong with me. I was with a student group tour in Germany. My foot was on the wheel cover of the bus and it was shaking, a calming mechanism I usually don't even know I'm doing. The girl sitting in front of me turned around and glared. Would you please stop shaking your leg, she said. It's making me nauseous. I stopped embarrassed and I thought, my God, what's wrong with me? My mother took me to my first therapist when I was 14, a guy who blew smoke rings as he interrogated me. Why won't you talk about your father? He asked, oblivious to my dad's abuse and intimidation. Everyone has something to say about their father, he said as I began to cry. But then I knew something is definitely wrong with me. So what is wrong with me? Do they want to hear about the borderline personality disorder, generalized anxiety disorder, secondary bipolar disorder, PTSD, or anything else 31 therapists have diagnosed me with? Would they care about the long-term effects of taking Abilify, Topamax, Zoloft, Paxil, Lamotrigine, Ativan, and the list goes on and on? Nah, where I work, they just hope I can act normal. Well, fuck you. This is my normal. This is my human experience. This is all I know. And I am tired of apologizing for who I am, what I do, how I act, and how I cope. Yes, there is something wrong with me. I am not normal. But I've seen enough of normal people to know I would rather be me. And there is nothing wrong with me. This next poem is an excerpt, from a work called Eloped by Angela Ellis, a local poet, and it was published in the Deaf Poets Society, and I'm honored to read this. She is in the field, buttercups, clover, Queen Anne's lace as ragged as the house curtains in her nightmares. Black pants and t-shirt, too loose on her now, and black Chinese-style slippers. The slippers would be too large if her feet weren't swollen from something they put in the water, maybe. She is in the field, with no money, no ID. Soon a mechanical elephant will lumber through the cars to save her. If she managed to smile at the bus driver, a normal smile, he might let her ride free to the airport. She could call Daniel, he could accept the charges, fly to meet her, take her someplace safe. Daniel, my brother, do you still feel the pain? She is in the field, alone in bad company. Although Joseph once said she was good company despite all his other women, before his eyes became gray marbles whenever he looked at her, before he gave her an infection that never went away. She is in the field, and when her best friend came to the hospital, Anne, the only friend she trusts, Joseph gave Anne his fake kind look, and Anne was fooled. Even Anne, who said with real tears in her eyes, sweetie, I'm so sorry. I wish that I could help you. She's in the field, unable to force one normal smile. She can't remember the last time she could. It must have been before Dr. Janice told Joseph that she was having a complete breakdown, and fake kind Joseph promised to help her. She is in the field, eloped, escaped from the psychiatric ward. The door of the ward clicked shut behind her, and a bored blonde nurse, and voila, she was in the regular part of the hospital. When the corridor widened suddenly, beautifully, into a lobby with a revolving glass door, she bolted to the right through the sharp slice of daylight that led to the outside. She is in the field with three choices. Wait here for the orderlies to find her, go back to the hospital on her own, or throw herself under the treacherous bus. If she was as smart as she was supposed to be, once upon a time even Joseph called her smart, she would have hoarded her pills and swallowed them with a glass of milk, instead of letting Joseph find her with an unopened bottle, shaking the orange cylinder like a gourd filled with dead seeds. She is in the field, and there is no way out. Only the way back, through the revolving door that lured her with its fragment of salvation. Now that door will suck every ray of light inside, like sobs stifled in the night, stealing her eyes in the cruel field of her fate.
Next, we have a reading by Alvin Woestein called Frail Fae.
After my mental health crisis, I was assimilated back into society with a placement in a personal care home with elder Jewish adults. So this was an expression of something that happened there that affected me, made me depressed. The Passover season came, the holiday of Jewish birth and rediscovery. Those that are able to prepare for the celebration, removing leavened foodstuffs, cleaning out cabinets, refrigerators, changing dishes and cookware, the memory lingers. As the years pass, we let the next generation slowly take over. My table mate sitting to my left is a 100-year-old Fae, frail, hunched over, unable to walk without a walker, 90 pounds, sat quietly at the Seder. How many times had she made the Seder? How many matzo balls, gefilte fish, had she made? How much chicken soup had she meticulously simmered? We waited anxiously for the meal to start. The Seder meal is an unfolding order of significant foods. Every item triggers a memory. Every taste reminds us of long-lost relative that has special recipe. The foods help to connect. They can take you back in time. Ah, the chicken soup. Pepper, salt, carrots, celery, parsnips, onion all contribute to the pleasure. But the most important ingredient is the cruel discipline of patience. You have to be strong to let the soup simmer. It may take hours. Do not be seduced. Keep the heat low. Do not raise the temperature. Fae is a master Jedi chicken soup maker. The chicken soup is served. From her frail body, a soft shriek comes. It's water, it's cold water, she cries. One spoonful and holiday spirit is gone. No more food. Fae goes back to the room. The whole room erupts. Cold water, the festive mood dissipates. We do our best. What happened? Did we not deserve to partake in a chicken soup meditation? The connection now is weaker. The magic has dispelled. The chef comes out of the kitchen and profusely apologizes. The supervising rabbi did not ask for the soup. He just served the water from the matzo ball preparation. Thank you.
So this is a little bit different for me, but I'm actually going to perform one of my own pieces for the first time. This piece was previously performed anonymously at a February anonymous open mic. And I'll warn you, it swears a couple of times, so get ready. It's not that bad. So this piece is called Throw Dollar Signs at Our Wounds, and it is about a previous employer of mine. Every day I walk into work and no one says hello to me. Some days, people even forget I'm there. Every day I walk into work and I have to sit quietly and listen while my bosses discriminate against my community, openly and with impunity. Every day I walk into work and I hear them whispering. I wonder if it's about me, because I'm part of the population that they serve. No, shake it off, because they want to gaslight me. See, you wouldn't expect that from a nonprofit organization, would you? Aren't they supposed to serve us, help us, but monetize us, co-opt our voices, push us into the margins of society, then feel good because they help the crazy people? I don't need your fucking help. Take your hands off my life. But you'll continue to provoke me, make me feel less. And then when I snap, you'll call me crazy. The signs were always there, those goddamn borderlines. I fantasize about quitting, but I need the health care. But the toxicity of this job is making me need that health care. I fantasize about quitting, but I know they'll control the narrative. But it's my goddamn narrative to control. I fantasize about quitting, but then what? I don't know. I just know that it will be better than crying in the bathroom, screaming in my car, and constantly wondering if I'm fit for this world, if I'm crazy. Turns out, I am crazy, but not in your inspirational way. But please, market my trauma for your benefit. It'll get you some donations to help the very people that you yourself exploit. It feels good, doesn't it? Thank you. So next, I'm going to welcome Mike McCarthy to the stage to perform an anonymous piece called Borderlines.
Some years ago, I was having a rough patch. One night, took it into my head to cut my wrist. Now, I was not a stranger to suicide attempts, but after staring at the damage long enough to realize something needed to be done right now, if at all, and not being entirely sure I even wanted to pursue that, I called someone who called 911, who sent the police in a paddy wagon. I was whisked away to a medical ER to be stitched up and then sent off to the local psychiatric hospital. But when the doctor came to repair, he looked at me very strangely. Grabbing my arm roughly, he asked what had happened. I felt as a doctor, he should be man enough to handle psychiatric matters, and told him what happened. He took out the needle to numb me up, but even I could tell he was aiming it well away from where it needed to be. Two nurses in the doorway watched, blocking the exit, and said it was a shame to waste the shot, as I clearly liked the pain. As the doctor began to stitch, I nearly came off the table and announced I could feel that, but he simply stared coldly right through me and kept on going until the wound was sealed. Now, if I was able to patch myself up, one does and goes on with things. But more often we go to the doctors with the thought that they will set us right. At that moment, the man became as dangerous to me as a serial killer. A person who did not see me as much as a human being. I know I'm not alone in such an experience. At the time, there was no such notion as a patient advocate, as we have now. So I knew this was the end of the line. But I wonder if some place can ever exist where medicine and psychiatric end their separation and see the wounded and the broken as traps without the trappings and delineation of diagnosis. I just wonder. Thank you.
So next we have Keeping Up with the Kulkarnis by Justin Takar.
So I think I can probably do a picture book thing with this, maybe. We'll find out.
You want the mic?
No.
This one, no, you...
What?
Pick one mic.
Oh, for Christ's sake.
Well, it'll actually be harder to do this that way, because, I mean, I need to be able to show people the thing.
You can use the handheld mic. Oh, no, she's signing.
Oh, okay. All right. Well. So here's an important question. Can you all
hold the mic?
So it's like,
do you want me to hold the mic? For you no one, people in the background are gonna hear you.
I am pretty loud a lot of the time. Can you really not hear me back there? Can you hear me now?
Alright, well no mic then.
Wait, here's a more important question. Can everyone see this at all? A little bit? Okay. All right. Then maybe I can do this. I can do it with or without the pictures. But I'm going to try to do it with the pictures. So this is about school and what it felt like for me, right? And I don't know if you're going to be able to see it all the way, but this is a picture of me on a sinking boat, pumping water as fast as I can to try to get it out of the thing, and still somehow staying afloat. School has pretty much always felt like shit. I'm in an engineering program. I don't really want to be. I've always been in STEM stuff in order to try to see if I can get myself to do it. And you know, it is definitely fulfilling in some ways. It's definitely not fulfilling in other ways. Because there's always this hovering stress of like, you know, here's me talking to myself, right? Here's this like, this cherubic voice in my head saying, you know, let's go shopping for that tent and sleeping bag that you'll need for whenever, you're homeless. Because that's what's going to happen. And I just progressively get more tired and more stressed. And I say back to the voice, thank you for saying this to me. Thank you for being this constant reminder, right? Now for me, I'm half Indian, I'm half white. I grew up around a lot of, you know, highly successful Indian families. So there's definitely this element of like keeping up with the Joneses, in this case, keeping up with the Kulkarnis, right? And, you know, you see them in their swift yacht sailboat thing just going so breezily through, you know, the school system and just seemingly badassing everything and being the most wonderful valedictorians ever. You know, even though you're in the storm. And that definitely seems to have an effect. And that's definitely something that's been with me for most of my life. And there's definitely an indignance. For those of you who can see this picture, I am looking at the person in the fast sailboat, just with my red circles for eyes, going like, what are you doing? How are you doing this? And that's basically the experience. It's a competitive and like a mercenary atmosphere at times. All these people competing and competing so hard. And we'll put ourselves through all kinds of crap that's probably not good for our long-term health. My parents did it. My cousins on the white side and the Indian side have plenty of friends and, you know, we all did it. We have plenty of friends and acquaintances that did it. High functioning, but extremely stressed out, or high functioning misery. As I was, I was told that, like, there are psychologists who really should be working on that, trying to figure out what that is. honestly. What is high-functioning misery? Because there seem to be so many people that push themselves so hard in their profession, but they don't know how to stop the stress. How do we not get addicted to that ambition, that drive to keep trying to be like some of our peers? I don't know. But that's the problem. Formulation of the dilemma that we're in. And you know, there were it's such a world to be part of. There's these extravagant weddings to be part of where, you know, it's two doctors getting married, and then there's like people who flew in from, you know, India for the weekend. You know, they fly in from India for 2 days to attend this wedding, and they look like Amal Clooney, George Clooney's wife, right? They look like Indian supermodels and you know, and actors and actresses. And, you know, and I've gone up to some of these people and tried to, you know, talk to them. And, you know, as a young man, tried to flirt perhaps. And I'll just get responses like, oh, honey, of course I'm not interested. I run a fucking NGO, you know. And so that's definitely been a part of my dad and I's experience. So how do you take all this and put it into something that might be... How do you explain this cultural shitstorm? How do you analyze what it is to be part of two different things, two different whole, you know, cultures at once? I don't really know. But I have some idea. I'd like to take a couple of characters and just sort of... I'd like to take... You know, one really successful character, one of these archetypes of one of the families I grew up around, you know, who's, you know, off in business school, got a full ride to Tepper at CMU for their MBA program, right? And make it so that she grows up with someone like me. This is Priya. You can't, again, you might not be able to see, but, you know, she's dressed in a gray and purple hoodie, and you know, and just has all sorts of eyeshadow on, and just looks very depressed in general, right? How do those two characters interact? The one who has the perfect success story, and the one who is a little more who is taking on the burden of, you know, that cultural divide more. And you know, how. And then them growing up, them, you know, going through whatever relationships and emotional difficulties they have, and, you know, for instance, the more successful one, taking the less successful one, say, to the hospital in the case of, you know, some sort of, you know, bad thing happening, right? You know, I don't have the friend who's like that, but I have... You know, this seems to be it's a realistic enough experience so that you really could explore a lot about how ambition affects a person and then, like, see how someone who cares about their friend would react to that person. And get some real context for what that ambitious, high-functioning depression or anxiety would look like. So that's my idea. I want to try to take these characters and have them play off of each other, see if you can get more insight into depression, anxiety, stress, ambition, through the playing off of these characters. The day-to-day moments, the individual interactions, the conversations on the phone. And I haven't done this yet, but if you go through all of that, I think you can get a much more complete picture of these issues than we normally see. Hopefully one that will really, really help and really give some people some catharsis. Anyway, if you want to actually see the pictures, you can see it at the blog's name is tomschoolery.blogspot.com. I would hope that you look at it. I work really hard on these whiteboard images for the thing. I put them in the Photoshop afterwards. They are really pretty. You'll like them. I think it would definitely do better to see it in the format, and hopefully it would be give you some idea of what's possible to do with these emotions, with these really complex emotions in an illustrated way. Thank you.
So for our final performer of the evening, we have Kim Liebach, who will be performing an anonymous work as well as one of her own.
This first piece is called Who by Anonymous. Who are you, child? Are you a person or are you your pain? Are you made up of raw nerves, broken skin, and salty tears? Are you greater than your pain, or are you merely equal to it? Choose wisely, for this choice will dictate the rest of your life. You wear the label mentally ill, like you're proud of your dysfunction. Stop it! Be ashamed. Well, don't be ashamed, but don't flaunt it either. Your personality's disordered, don't you know? You're broken and wrong. Didn't you know that? I'm the only person who will ever love you, ever look past that cesspool you call your mind. I'm really doing you a favor, you know? Just go away. I don't want to look at such a train wreck. I mean no disrespect. You're just ruined as a person. I have no use for you anymore. You're useless to me unless you're happy. This one's my own. I kind of didn't finish it. But this month, was the first Insider Minds event I attended. And I submitted a piece which somebody beautifully did. So this year, seeing as it's 365 days later, I decided to write an update to that piece. It ended on a hopeful note. Let's see how the last 365 days treated me. So the piece was called Beautifully Broken Girl, A Letter to My Future Self. Well, now it's a past letter to my future self. Hi, Beautifully Broken Girl, you're back again. It's exactly been 1 year since you sat locked in your bedroom on a rainy Saturday in June 2017, dictating your piece to your iPhone, bemoaning your self-esteem and love for the man who watches you now behind tired eyes, dragged to be your steadfast confidence in the back of the room. Or in this case, through his phone. Only days prior did the transient souls that lived in your living room vacate the premises. Little did you know that before long, you'd play hostess to 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 more people in your living room, two of which still remain to today, but they're leaving soon, hopefully. But they needed help. You needed help once. So you know how it feels to be out on the streets and alone and no one to turn to. You don't want to ask for help, but you need it. It's okay to ask for help. You've learned that now. It's okay to say, I can't. It's okay to say no too. So going back 1 year ago, you had no idea how closely the love of your life would come to flirting with Mistress Death. Less than 30 days after the Glitterbox Theater. You would come home from work. He seemed fine in the middle of the day. You would come home to a shell of the person you loved, shaking and cold, adamant that he was okay. You held him all night. In the morning, he asked for his father. His father who had been gone for 3 years. And you knew. You knew that something was very wrong. So you went into Hulk mode, tossed his butt in the car, and ran to the hospital. If you hadn't done that, the doctor said, if I'd gone to work like I had planned, my life would be so drastically different today, and I wouldn't know who I was. So after 3 days in the ICU, 3 more days in a step-down unit, he finally came home after 6 of the longest days of your life, most of which was spent on a couch in his room, except for the one day they kicked you out. You were not happy about that, but you convinced yourself he needed the rest. That job you loved, on his 30th birthday, that September, that left you too. After all of the work you put in, the commute was just not worth it. Driving to the bus stop, getting on the bus, taking a tea after the bus, and then walking a half mile to your branch, 9 times out of 10 with a cane? And you're expected to be there right on time? With these buses, they wouldn't transfer you closer to home. So they just gave you the boot out the door. So since then, it's been 1, 2, 3, 4. Can we count 4 jobs that I've had and lost in the past 6 months? For somebody who's worked since they were 16 years old, that messes with you. That makes you feel like you're not good enough, that you're broken, irreparably broken. But if something I learned in this past year is that I might be, but don't broken crayons still color? Don't broken roads still get driven on? Don't broken pieces come back together unless they're missing a piece or you don't have really good super glue? I have good super glue. I have really good friends, more friends I've made the past year. I have love of my life, which not many people find that. I have family. I have something that not a lot of people have these days. I have hope. And though maybe some things didn't work out like I wanted them to, maybe it's not supposed to. And that's okay. But I'll tell you one thing. If there's one thing that hasn't left me, it's hope. And even in the darkest of nights, don't the stars shine so bright? Don't you need the darkness to see the light? You do. I do. And the further you stray from the city, the darker the night becomes, the brighter the lights become, and you can see clearer. So get away from the bustle of the city and the city lights, so entrancing. Because out in the wilderness, there's hope. Maybe the wilderness is camp, a vacation, something new. Or maybe your wilderness is knowing that in yourself, you're okay. And that as long as you have hope, that's where hope will stay.
So thank you all for coming today. I hope you had a good time and heard some awesome stories. Feel free to take the next 15 minutes to get more food and drink, introduce yourself to a new friend, talk to our performers, and we're super glad to have you here. And one final note, because as executive director, I must, Inside Our Minds is completely run by donations. All our events are free and open to the community. So if you enjoyed yourself today and are in a place to donate, you can do so back by the food and drinks. Thank you.